How do you extend the brand of a successful newspaper into a men's magazine? As many commentators continue to bemoan the fall of print news, one German publisher has released a new title to newsstands. The key, some say, is all about knowing your strengths and keeping a firm grip on your brand. We'll talk to the people behind some of the most successful print ventures today on The Stack. On today's program, the art director of graphic design Title I tells us why the key to good publishing is all in the eye.
We're kind of living in an age when there's a suspicion about too much art direction. You know, too much art direction kind of feels a bit like advertising, and people aren't always comfortable with that.
Plus, the new German title that's just leapt from the pages of one of Europe's most successful newspaper brands.
It's never too late to, you know, make a decision in your life to become a happier person, you know, whether you're 96 or whether you're 26. And so that kind of became the motto for Zeitmagazin Mann.
And the fashion magazine that's not all that concerned about keeping up with the latest trends. That's today on The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack. I'm Ben Rylan. To call this magazine eye-catching wouldn't quite do it justice. Billed as one of the world's most beautiful and collectible graphic design journals, Eye is a quarterly title dedicated to critical and informed writing about design and visual culture. Simon Esterson is the magazine's art director. He joins me here in the studio today. Simon, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Now, first of all, walk me through the concept for the magazine. We're looking at the latest issue here. It's got a bright orange colour scheme just on the initial front cover. On the inside, there's quite a selection of different ways to explore what's ostensibly the world of print. Tell me about where you begin.
Well, we try and make a magazine that's tactile and interesting. And you know, a large proportion of our audience are graphic designers, and we expect them to appreciate paper changes and special colours and short pages. It's just part of the techniques now we use for making a printed object, really.
I mean, so much of the journalistic world, I suppose you could call it, relies heavily on digital formats now. How do you think that has impacted the world of print from the way you attack it from the design perspective?
Well, I think it's a fascinating problem about how you write about digital design in a printed magazine, and that's something we're always kind of challenged by and working on. You know, how do you talk about websites and digital typefaces and things in print? We tend to use digital as a kind of support mechanism for the magazine. So we have a huge Twitter following, Instagram following, emails, websites, but those are really ways of reminding people that the magazine is published, a way of highlighting certain things in it. But we try to keep the printed magazine as a printed object, so you can't download a PDF, for example.
I mean, you've gone a little bit meta on this page that I've just opened up to here, where we've got...
This is the feature on Riposte magazine.
Exactly. Yeah. So we've got a magazine inside a magazine, which is itself an interesting concept. It's not something you see every day. But of course, I mean, we're talking right now. We are a magazine who has a radio show, and we're talking about other magazines. I mean, that's sort of keeping it within the family. How important is that, do you think, to the industry as a whole?
I think it's fun to be a niche publication, isn't it? So, you know, yes, we're here talking on a radio station. Last night we had the New Zealand type designer Chris Sowersby, who was in London, giving a lecture for us at the St. Bride's Institute. So that was a complete sort of sellout with a brilliant young type designer talking about his work. I think it's nowadays there's a really interesting balance between being able to access everything digitally all the time, but the difference that you can have, it's kind of made us reassess personal contact. You know, you can follow Chris Sowersby on Twitter and it's fine, but actually, you know, we had 150 people last night who wanted to sit in a room and hear him talk.
So I've just opened up to another page here, page 60. Now, this feature that you've got here is called Time Machine.
Tom's conceit is that every year he visits the same 20 sites and he photographs them from exactly the same position, ideally with the same camera and the same film, although changes in technology have made that slightly difficult. And so John Walters, who's Eye's editor, followed Tom on one of his recent annual treks. I think it's been going for 43 years now. So you see the same scene photographed every year for 43 years. And Tom's pictures are kind of unmediated. You know, these are not art-directed pictures. These are not styled pictures. He literally gets his camera out and takes a picture, and he doesn't always check the exposure and things like that. So they're very, there's an incredible kind of authenticity about them. And you look across the sites and you can see some sites that haven't really changed in that period. You know, a tree grows, a tree's cut down. Other places, houses have been built and knocked down, and new houses built and knocked down. And it's a sort of slow motion freeze frame history of that bit of South London.
Well, it's so interesting to look at these pictures, because you just mentioned there that these pictures are quite intentionally not art directed, and yet basically through the treatment of time has made it feel as though they are very much art directed. It's just funny how our perspectives on those sorts of things can change things, isn't
it?
Yeah,
and you know, art direction is a really interesting issue. You take an interiors magazine like Appartamento, which I'm sure you've talked about lots of times on the programme. And part of the essence of that is that those interiors are not really art directed. They're not art directed in the way that you would, they're not cleaned up in the way that you'd expect an interior in House and Garden or something to be cleaned up. And I think we're kind of living in an age when there's a suspicion about too much art direction. You know, too much art direction kind of feels a bit like advertising, and people aren't always comfortable with that.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Ryland. Simon Esterson is the art director of Eye Magazine. He's with me here in the studio. We'll have more from him in just a moment. German publication The Heritage Post created quite a stir in the men's magazine market with the launch of its first issue back in 2012. The magazine aims to discuss not the latest fashion trends, but the enduring appeal of certain products, from classic footwear to a motorbike. With its beautiful and collectible covers, the magazine has its eyes set firmly on international readers and has even launched an English edition. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to one of the editors, Matthias Lösel.
The Heritage Post has really been a labor of love for me, and particularly for Stefanie Kobayashi and Uwe van Affenden, who are the publishers and the editors-in-chief of the Heritage Post. The magazine as such has been inspired by the Saturday Evening Post as far as the design is concerned. For those of you who are not familiar with the Saturday Evening Post, was a magazine that was being published by the end of the 19th century until, 1963 or something, and had these great artsy graphic designs on the front page. Basically no headlines, no catchy slogans on the front cover, just a great image. And that's basically how I discovered the Heritage Post for myself, and how Uwe van Affenden and Stefanie Kobayashi wanted it to look like. It has this very clean, old-fashioned, in a good sense, very visual design that says, well, this is a men's magazine, but it's totally different from all the other men's magazines that you can get.
The magazine, I mean, you guys are based in Germany, but now, of course, there's also the English edition of the magazine. That's quite interesting. So what is this? Is it you guys trying to go to other markets as well besides Germany?
It's a very good question. It has to do with how the Heritage Post in Germany started, because Uwe van Affenden has been a very well-known character in the fashion and interior design scene around Düsseldorf. And he's run several shops for vintage clothing, vintage furniture, etc. And he has always been offered free giveaway magazines from, you know, all those GQ and all that stuff. And he always wanted to have a magazine that doesn't say, well, if you want to be a cool guy, you have to buy the new Ferrari that you can never afford. He was looking for great magazines that tell you about good products that have always been good, like for 100 years. And he found those magazines in Japan or in the United States. And that's how he got his inspiration to do the Heritage Post. And now that the Heritage Post is running in its fourth year since its first publication, we've had so many demands from the other side, actually, from Japan, from the United States, from France, from England as well. And they told us, well, you have this great magazine, but it's in German, so is there any chance you will one day do an English issue? And that's basically what we did about a year ago. We've had so much demand from other countries, from other people who are interested in this vintage heritage thing, that we took up the risk to do an English edition, and I'm very proud to say that it's running very well.
To which man is the magazine aimed for?
Well, basically to everyone who's interested in good stuff. To put it in one slogan, maybe, quality is to a product what character is to a man. So when Uwe, the publisher, had his first clothing shop in Düsseldorf, he was trying to make people conscious about the importance of the quality of a product. That, for example, a pair of Levi's vintage denim has to be twice or three times the price of a cheap jeans that's been manufactured by children in Bangladesh or in Vietnam, whereas a good pair of Levi's vintage jeans has been handmade out of white oak cone denim in San Francisco by honest workers. So his aim was to make people conscious about the fact that quality is important, and that quality has a price, and that quality also is a political issue. I mean, you cannot expect to buy a t-shirt for £3 at Primark and think that it's been manufactured fairly or under fair circumstances somewhere in Asia. So this is basically what the magazine is aiming at, to make people aware of products that have always been good and will be good even in 100 years, because they're manufactured with love, with a good conscience, under fair means, and with good ingredients.
And Matthias, I have a question here as well. I was talking about expansion, you know, now we have an English edition as well. I also received in the post, thanks for sending, a copy of the Interior Post as well. Is it going to be part of the same family of the Heritage Post, but talking about home decor, for example?
Exactly. It makes the family complete. We started with the men's issue of the Heritage Post. Then 2 years later, we started with the women's issue of the Heritage Post. And now it's been like Uwe van Afferden's and Stefanie Kobayashi's dream to have the third child in the family, the Interior Post, which is basically about all the things that Uwe once started with. Good design, classical design, interior design, designers, photographers, all that stuff. And we've just published our third issue now, and it's running quite well as well. The reception's great.
Absolutely. And finally, Matthias, when is the next issue coming out?
The next men's issue will be out by the end of October. Our main focus in that issue will be Great Britain.
Wow.
We've always been fans, me personally, of Great Britain for a very long time. I've started when I was 15 years old. I was a young aspiring mod with my little scooter and all, and the Who written on the back of my parka. So we felt the urge to do an issue about Great Britain. So there are all the things in it that you might expect brand-wise. Like, we have an article about Fred Perry. We have something about the myth of the Harrington jacket. I've been writing a long article about the Tinder sticks. So all the things that men like me, or like Uwe, or hopefully all the people that read our magazine would hope to find in something like the Heritage Post.
Matthias Losel from the Heritage Post chatting to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland. I'm joined here in the studio by Simon Esterson. He is the art director of the graphic design journal I. Simon, you've brought in your own stack of magazines for us to have a look through today. Let's dive in. There's quite a few, I have to say. My table here is just about completely covered. I think I want to start with this one that you were talking to me about as you walked into the studio a little earlier. Now, this one is on its way to subscribers at the moment, isn't it? Arriving in mailboxes in
the
moment now.
This is a magazine called Pulp that the I team make for the Italian paper manufacturer Fedragoni.
It's absolutely beautiful just on first glance. Explain to me the cover, first of all, though.
Well, one of the things about the magazine is we have the choice of all the papers made by Fedragoni. And so this is a coloured paper. It's a tinted, textured paper. And we've taken a line engraving of the famous Italian printer and publisher, Aldus Manutius. We've blown that line engraving up hugely, and then just printed it in black on the coloured stock. And then add a little bit of gold foiling in the top left-hand corner.
Gold foiling, just enough of it to be eye-catching enough as well. So explain to me the insides of the magazine then. So you're producing this for Fedragoni.
Yes, it's the brief is to make a magazine about people and paper. So it's about designers and writers and what they use paper for. the kind of papers they use, the kind of papers they're interested in. So this issue's got a piece about a box magazine from Paris.
A box magazine?
Yeah, the magazine comes in a box.
It comes in a box. It's not about boxes.
No, but we have got a feature about boxes as well. Because, funny you should say that. we have an amazing piece of example of box engineering made by the designer Jim Sutherland with an English box company, where we have a box within a box within a box. we have a piece about packaging.
I just found the box feature here, actually.
Yeah. We try to cover the range of everything from magazine production to packaging to specialist papers. And we use those in the manufacturing of the magazine.
Do you find that people, obviously people working within your line of work are probably going to, on occasions, become quite intensely interested in the intricacies of paper and cardboard and so on?
Yes. No, it's true. I was sitting outside in your reception. There's a very nice Wink brochure with three straps of colour on it.
Yes.
But I actually think it's three different bits of paper, types of paper that have been duplexed together. So it's that kind of thing. We go around, you know, collecting samples and looking at things and seeing how they're made.
We've spoken to a lot of people on this particular show before who have spoken honestly about how long it has taken them to basically weed through all of the different options that they had for paper when they were starting their magazine. And just to hear that, I mean, someone coming to this from the outside world probably wouldn't consider that choosing your type of paper would be one of the hardest parts about starting a magazine. But for a lot of people, it very much is. What to put on the paper comes quite easily by comparison. Do you find that?
I think one of the things, especially with independent magazines, is the print runs are quite short. So suddenly, if you're doing a million copies of a magazine, your paper choice is quite limited because you can't spend a lot of money. And you've often got mailing considerations. If you're doing a reasonably short run independent magazine, suddenly there's a bigger range of choice. And it's, you know, you start with white papers and do you want a glossy paper or a semi-matte paper or a matte paper? And those questions are about the kind of things you want to put on the paper and, to a certain extent, the skill of your printer to make it work. Then you can move into ivory papers and coloured papers. And in that issue of Pulp, we have this amazing Fedrigoni paper that has a raster pattern in it. So if you look at it very closely, there's actually embossed in the paper is a diagonal pattern and just completely changes the texture of the paper.
Love hearing about that detail. Let's move on to some of your other titles, though. Time is relatively short,
sure,
but we've got plenty of time to have a flick through at least a couple of these. Where shall we move to next?
Well, what I did, of course, was just drop into Mag Culture on the way here. So this is King's Review, which is made by ex-Cambridge students. And I think it's an example of a really strong trend at the moment, which is the sort of long read magazine book form. And they're not heavily illustrated, or if they're illustrated, it's very controlled. They're the kind of format of kind of bigger sort of B format paperback books. I mean, kind of Grantor, I suppose, is the obvious historical example. But they are not necessarily about fiction. They're about contemporary reporting. My favourite one is actually Reportagen from Switzerland, which you may have talked about on the programme before. It's essentially a monthly magazine of long-form reporting. This is the five-year anniversary issue. And there's something about the size, the sort of journal approach of these magazines that marks them out from newsstand magazines. You know, they don't have four-colour covers. This has got a very elegant coloured paper and lots of cover lines in a kind of almost like a poster, a mini poster front cover.
Magazines like this one, and I always love magazines like these, they're just so confident in being able to present what they are quite up front. And it always speaks to the versatility of the magazine format, doesn't it? That you can have a magazine that is very, very picture heavy, very graphic heavy. Or you can have something that's very word-heavy, like these two titles here. I mean, they're basically very long reads all the way through them, one more than the other, definitely. But you can have titles like this or like the former and be just as legitimate and hold just as much a place on the newsstand as any of the others.
No, absolutely. I think the interesting thing about them, whether they're lots of text or whether they're heavily illustrated is they kind of step outside the conventional publishing model, in magazine model. You know, you must have text with info panel boxes and you can have a certain kind of picture, but it can't be too big. And, you know, that's what independent publishing enables you to do, is to ignore those kind of nostrums about how you make a magazine.
Simon Esterson, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
And finally today, we turn the page to another German title that's freshly arrived on newsstands from the publishing house behind one of Europe's most admired newspapers. Die Zeit has just released a new men's title called Zeit Magazine Man. The volume is set to hit newsstands twice a year with a 60,000 print run edited by Christoph Amend. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco dialed up Christoph for a chat.
Actually, the very first moment of maybe thinking about launching a men's magazine was by analyzing the situation of men's magazines in Germany, where, you know, you have these special interest titles, but you don't have a sort of more general interest-orientated magazine for men, for grown-up men, I would also say, in ad. But sort of from an emotional point of view, it actually happened in a restaurant in Portugal.
Oh, wow. How interesting. Tell me more about it.
Well, the thing is, I go out to Portugal on vacation occasionally to the Atlantic coast, you know, near Lisbon, near Sintra. And so one evening during one of the holidays I spent there, the restaurant owner, who I know quite well, came over to our table at the end of the evening, more or less, and said, "Well, this is a great white wine, Christoph. You should try it. It's from Baron Brümmer." And I sort of said, "Well, Baron Brümmer, that doesn't sound Portuguese, right? Is that German or Swiss?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, it's this old man. He lives in the next village nearby. And I think he's German, yeah." So I kind of, I was kind of curious, and I kind of did some research, and I found out that it's actually a German guy. And when he was 96, he had just survived a very tough illness and just, you know, got himself together again, and then declared and told his family, "You know what, we're going into the wine business now." So really everyone thought he was crazy. But what happened, he actually started producing wine, and today he's 104 years old, still alive, and is the oldest wine producer in Europe, and the wine is really nice. And when I heard that story, I thought, wow, you know, it's never too late to, you know, make a decision in your life to become a happier person, you know, whether you're 96 or whether you're 26. And so that kind of became the motto for Zeitmagazin Mann.
Fantastic. And it's also, as you say, you're talking about Baron Brümmer as well. It's a very interesting choice as well, because, you know, he's not exactly a celebrity or a CEO of a huge company as well. So it's quite an interesting angle. So perhaps, I mean, are you interested in those kind of things that perhaps like your average men's title would not cover, perhaps?
Well, thanks if you say so. I mean, we sent photographer Nacho Alegre, who's also, you know, as you know, one of the publishers of Apartamento magazine, to photograph Baron Brümmer in Portugal. And we also sent a reporter there. And so we have that profile on Baron Brümmer in the first issue. And there's a couple of other men that I thought were interesting. For example, there was a guy who was basically a criminal in his, I think, first 30 or 40 years of his life. And then he met a man in Jamaica. He's a German, but he met this guy in Jamaica, and he kind of turned his life upside down. So this man came back to Germany and, you know, started writing crime stories. So today he's one of the most successful writers for the very famous and very successful German crime TV show Tatort, and has totally left the criminal side. So it's not about celebrities only, but of course, you know, it's also about celebrities. On the cover of our first magazine, first issue, we have actor Christoph Waltz,
which is actually one of the few, you know, German-speaking actors that are doing extremely well in Hollywood as well. So that's quite an interesting choice.
Well, thanks. I mean, you know, what we tried to do with him was we talked with his agent for about 2 years when we started planning the magazine.
Oh, 2 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because we spoke to her and said, well, you know, we like his work, we like, you know, the way he lives his life, and we really want to do the, you know, the one great story with him. So we kind of waited, and one day she called me and said, well, you know, if you're ready, we're ready. And so we asked Peter Lindbergh if he would be interested to photograph him, and then we, you know, went to Hollywood, went to Los Angeles and visited him. And he really took his time. We spent a whole day with him. And what I thought was sort of the most interesting, or one of the most interesting things of during the interview, was that I had actually found out that there was a point in his career before the Tarantino movies where he didn't have work for nearly a whole year. And his then wife talked to him and said, oh, you know, Christoph, you're so talented in so many different fields. You could do something else. You don't have to be an actor. And when I mentioned that to him, he really got a little furious and said, well, I was never thinking about doing something else. And no matter how successful I was, I always worked on this. And to become a really great actor, it needs 20 years.
And Christoph is very interesting. I mean, you mentioned that you guys have been in touch with Christoph for about 2 years. So that means that you were also actually thinking already about the magazine 2 years ago. I want to know a little bit more about, you know, the business plan of the magazine. How often will it come out? And do you have plans for an English edition as well? So tell me more about it.
Well, we positioned the magazine, Zeitmagazin Mann, as a biannual. So there will be two issues, spring, summer, and fall, winter, for the seasons, of course. And the circulation will be 60,000 copies. And that also makes sense because, you know, we have a weekly magazine with Zeit Magazine, and we do cover men and men's fashion in our weekly. And, you know, the weekly has a circulation of about 520,000 copies. So Zeitmagazin Mann is positioned in a different market, in a different field in terms of magazines. It's very interesting that you're mentioning that, asking me about actually doing it in English as well, or, you know, producing an English edition. I've been hearing that actually since we launched the magazine 3 weeks ago in Germany, especially from people abroad like you and people from Milan and Paris. So I don't know yet. We haven't figured it out. We keep listening, you know, what's happening. How do people react? How do readers react to the magazine? And, well, you never know. And I think it probably comes from, or sort of roots back in the fact that we are doing this international edition with Zeit Magazine twice a year. So I take it as a compliment.
Christoph Arment talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's it for this week's show. Fernando was our producer, and our trusty Claire Urban was our editor. And a special thanks to my guest today, Simon Esterson, the art director of I Magazine. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note over at info@monocle.com. And remember, we are back next Saturday at the same time. Tyler Brulé is in the chair for that one. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or at iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. You have been listening to The Stack. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.